Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You know, and I do talk about that at the end of the movie, like the two of the Marines who were on trial, like the younger one is sort of confused because they're convicted. Right. He's like, I don't understand what happened. And the older Marine says to him, we're Marines. It was our job to protect the innocent, to protect the weak. And we failed to do that. Right. That's the closing moment of the film. Right. That's the clincher of the film. And so then you read that back on Nicholson's character. Yeah, he's not the good guy.
You're listening to War College, a weekly podcast that brings you the stories from behind the front lines. Here are your hosts.
Hello, welcome to War College. I'm your host, Matthew Gault. With us today is Pauline Corinne. Corinne is the Stockdale Chair in Professional Military Ethics at the U.S. Naval War College and the author of the new book, On Obedience, Contrasting Philosophies for the Military Citizenry and Community. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so we do want to say up at the top that the views and opinions you express here are your own and do not reflect official policy or opinion of the U.S. Naval War College.
That is the truth.
So that said, how does it feel to have a book out that's got a hell of a news peg?
Yeah, it's a little weird. The book is turning out to be a lot more relevant than I imagined that it would be. I mean, these are kind of perennial issues that come up from time to time, but you know, the portions of the book that have to do with civil disobedience and disobedience within the military and civ-mil relations have in the last week gotten more confirmation than I would have imagined when I was writing the book.
Okay, so at the top here, can you define obedience for me? Because I think a lot of us hear that and we have kind of this knee-jerk reaction to that word, specifically in the American context, right?
Right.
So kind of what for the purposes of your book and kind of the, I wouldn't even call it an argument, but the exploration that you're making in the book, what is obedience?
Well, what I'm interested in the book is what you might think of as what would count as justified obedience. So I try to make a distinction between, you know, virtuous obedience and what is normally called blind obedience. Sort of, I'm just following orders. I'm just doing what I'm told on one hand, and on the other hand, what Tim O'Brien, the famous, fiction author who wrote The Things We Carried, he described his obedience in going to Vietnam sort of as passive obedience. So it's not that you're really choosing it. It's sort of the path of least resistance. So for me, obedience has to be intentional. It has to be the product of some kind of deliberation and intention and choice. And it's also when you choose to obey, it's a judgment about the thing that you're being asked to do. You are affirming that it at least is a reasonable thing to do and doesn't violate any sort of moral norms or moral or legal considerations. So I think it's a much narrower notion of obedience than typically we have, but that's part of the point of the book, is to say that not all obedience is morally a good thing, right? It's not necessarily just a good thing to do what you're told. And the book, you know, certainly looks at military examples, but the idea is also to look at how it works in a civilian context. And it, there's a lot of pop culture in the book, but there's also stories about my children, who are now teenagers, and obedience in the context of parenting. So the idea is to really explore what is the kind of obedience that we want, that is a good thing, and when ought we be obedient or less than obedient, or when ought we be disobedient or perhaps less than obedient.
One of the things that strikes me about the book, and I think a lot of good kind of philosophical and ethical works feel this way, is that it feels like you're working it out on the paper as you're writing it.
Yeah.
Right. And this is this is kind of like your it's like you had these questions on top of mind and are doing the research and looking through the historical and philosophical sources and kind of piecing together your own answers to these questions. I'm wondering why you were driven to tackle this subject. Like what was the impetus?
Yeah, that's a good question. And a lot of people ask me that, and you know, I don't know that I have a good, clean, I need to construct a better narrative. But all things, as in all things in life, it's sort of messy. So first of all, I'm a parent. So obedience comes up a lot sort of just in my personal life. And especially as my kids have gotten older, navigating, you know, the process of them becoming independent adults has me thinking about obedience. But as a moral question, it comes up a lot, and I taught undergraduate philosophy for, you know, for 20 years. And so the moral questions of obedience come up when I teach Antigone, Sophocles' play Antigone, or Shakespeare's Henry V, or a whole host of other sources in the history of philosophy. So especially in social and political philosophy and philosophy of law, which I taught a lot, the question of obedience and disobedience and civil disobedience is a sort of perennial issue you talk about. But then I was thinking about writing a book on this, and then the election of 2016 happened, and I was getting a lot of direct messages and emails from my colleagues in the military, sort of posing a lot of these questions. And also civilian people in my civilian university asking about civil disobedience. So I think the election of 2016 really crystallized some concerns that a lot of people had, especially, and I mentioned this in the book, that then candidate Trump had said on the question of war crimes that, if I command them to commit war crimes, referring to the military, they will do so. And that was a very sort of shocking statement to people who are members of the professional military. So I think it was sort of a perennial issue, something that I found interesting. I also noticed that there wasn't really a good philosophical treatment of obedience. There are good treatments of obedience from sort of a religious perspective, and then there's the civil disobedience literature. But there wasn't a good philosophical treatment of, well, what exactly is obedience? What is disobedience? How do we define these things? And so as an academic, when you see a gap in the literature, that's always a lovely thing, because that's something that's part of our job, is to address things that are perhaps unaddressed, or try to put our scholarly skills to use in working through those things. But I wanted to do that in a way that was not just a scholarly book, but that was accessible to people in a wide range of backgrounds and educational experiences, who could really, you know, think about this question, which is why the way the book is constructed, there's a lot of pop culture references. There's a discussion guide in the back, so people could use that either for personal reflection or for book groups or PME, or to be used perhaps in an undergraduate classroom. So I also wanted this book to be a different kind of book, contributing to the scholarly literature, but in a way that's more accessible. And I really liked how you described, the feeling of the book as I'm working through these questions along with the reader. And that was, I wanted to write the book in a way that would replicate what happens in my classes. And that was the intention of the book, that it would feel like you were in class with me and we were working together through these issues, and we'd maybe had some common readings and some discussion, and I would give my scholarly views of things, but also invite you to think about what you think, which is what happens in my classroom.
It's speaking of your classrooms, and maybe this is different because of where you're teaching, but when I hear the word obedience, I have a very, what I think of, American knee-jerk reaction to it. It's mostly pejorative. I immediately go to civil disobedience as being a very American and like the ethical and moral thing to do, right? I think of Henry David Thoreau. I think of the civil rights movement. You think of Gandhi. Why is it important to also look at, what are your thoughts on that specifically in kind of the American context, and why is it important to consider also obedience? And are there times when civil disobedience towards power is also kind of, in a weird way, being obedient towards the greater social contract?
Yeah, so there's a lot kind of packed in there. And I think as Americans, our American narrative is born out of acts of civil disobedience, from throwing some tea into the, the harbor, which is property destruction. One needs to be reminded. So our national birth narrative is rooted in disobedience. And through a variety of authors and experiences, we think of this idea of rebellion or obedience or disobedience as something that is maybe not particularly American, but it is very, American. And so I think it's something we pride ourselves on. And I think that that's somewhat of the, reaction when we think about the Nuremberg trials. We wanted to be able to say to people, just saying you were just following orders is not adequate. And so I think there is this piece in American history that probably rooted in the revolution, but also in the philosophical text of the revolution, that disobedience to some political powers at times can be obedience to natural law or to other kinds of moral considerations like justice. And if you look at what's going on in the streets right now, I think that's the argument that people are making. There is some disobedience that is going on. But the argument is that it is, as Martin Luther King Jr. said in his letter from the Birmingham jail, right, that he's appealing there to what we're disobeying is injustice, or we're disobeying unjust laws, which is a kind of obedience then to a higher just order, or to our obedience to our obligations to one another as citizens or within the military profession. So there's different ways of thinking about what is it that you're being obedient to and what is it that you're being disobedient to.
Right. I feel like obedience is at the center of a lot of what we're seeing right now. Police demand obedience, and they often use violence to extract it. And it feels as if people are now demanding a different kind of obedience from the police. And we're seeing the conflict between those. Obviously, it's a lot more complicated than that. There's a lot more going on. But do you think... I'm trying to think of how I want to phrase this. What would you want a police officer to take away from your book?
That obedience has to be justified, right? I don't just get to say to my children, you must obey me because I am your mother, even though I use that line a lot, right? But it's sort of joking, right? Because that's actually not obedience, that's deference. And in the book, I make a distinction between deference and respect. And then very often, both in the police context, we also find this in the military as well, that hierarchies produce a need for or desire for deference. I want you to do what I tell you or to show me what I think of as respect. not in virtue of something I've earned, but in virtue of that I hold a position or that I hold an office, even if I'm really bad at that office. So, when it comes to deference, I'll use sort of the Queen of England, right? It doesn't matter if she's good at being queen or not, right? The idea is we're supposed to give her deference because of the office or the position that she holds. And I think that you see that, especially in police forces where the culture is very toxic. Some of the responses we're seeing in the street are responses by police officers who expect deference. And when they receive anything that doesn't look like their notion of deference, then that is taken as disobedience. And then must be addressed usually with force. So, I would hope that some police officers would read my book and take away that obedience has to be earned. And in fact, in one of the chapters, I argue that obedience is actually a negotiation, the negotiation of authority. Which anyone who has teenagers will appreciate that that's exactly what's going on. But it's also something that happens in the military. You can only have command authority if the people you are commanding really allow you to. And I think that one of the things that we are seeing right now in the streets is a renegotiation of what in the military we call command authority. In political circles, we might think of it as a renegotiation of the legitimacy of state power, as if we think about the police as one instantiation of that. But also the political authorities, whether it's the president or other people, are finding that they're having to renegotiate the bounds of whatever authority they can wield or not. And so I think that's a core piece of obedience. Obedience is not blind, it's not passive, and it's not uncritical. In fact, I use the term critical obedience in the book. It's something we should think about, and it should be given. And I don't want to make it sound like it's always a bad thing. We need obedience to function. In a political society, I need obedience for my household to function. The military needs obedience for it to function. But not all kinds of obedience are necessarily good. And so the question then becomes, what kinds of obedience are good and necessary to society? And then what do we do when that's not what is happening or that's not what is being asked for?
Right. This ties into the conception of obedience as a virtue, right?
Right.
Which I think loads it down with some important implications. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, for something to be a virtue, going back to Aristotle and virtue ethics, it's a character or quality that we would expect in a moral person, or for Aristotle, a moral community. So saying something is a virtue is saying it's something that we want people to do. We want people to cultivate. And so it has to have some kind of intrinsic good. It has to have some kind of good to it. So that's kind of the first piece. But then virtues in Aristotle are not, I decide this is a virtue. That's a collective decision and negotiation about what that virtue looks like. Aristotle said we're all political animals. And what he meant by that is we exist in a polis, we exist in a political community, and it's that political community that gives rise and supports our morality or our virtue. So that's the first piece. The second piece that I try to bring into this account of obedience is some concepts from just war theory, which is the idea that, certain kinds of force or certain kinds of things have to have justification. And I think obedience, which very often, especially in the case of both the military and the police forces, comes with at least potentially lethal force, has to be justified. And so I use some of the concepts in just war theory, like proportionality and reasonable chance of success, as ways that we judge whether or not we should give our obedience. So in the chapter on negotiation, talk about some, the mutinies on the Western Front from French troops in World War I, when they essentially decided that they were being asked to fight battles there were no that there was no hopes of winning, and that would not conclude the war. And so you had lots of disobedient acts that ultimately culminated in outright mutiny. And what the French leadership found out was they had to basically renegotiate the terms of command obedience, otherwise their soldiers wouldn't fight. And so I think that shows us that obedience is a much more complicated thing than we normally think of it. And so I think it's interesting to explore. I hope the book asks people to think about where their lines are and what they would obey and what they would disobey.
Well, and I think a lot of people are asking themselves that question right now, right?
Absolutely, yes.
It's just like you think of it as this given thing, but the book really asks people to just kind of to think about it and to really consider kind of this precious thing that when you are in a position of power over other people, you know, there is this negotiation there. And it shouldn't just be blind obedience. Should not be the norm. We should be thinking about these things actively. So if you are an officer in the military, or if you are a police officer, how do you make sure, how do you train these two groups of people to consider these questions and be thinking about obedience in this way?
Yeah, that's a great question. That seems to be the sort of $1 million question right now. I think part of it has to be you need to think about the culture of your institution. And if the culture of your institution is built on deference, or it is built on that it is the use of or the threat of lethal force that gets you respect or gets you your authority, if that's how you think about things, so sort of we're all familiar with the sheepdog, you know, narrative, like I'm here to protect the sheep and all that kind of,
Dave Grossman killology, Dave Grossman, bullshit.
Right. That whole thing, that's a very toxic narrative. And if you think of obedience and commanding obedience in those terms, we're already in trouble before we even get started. So I think people who train and educate military people like I do, or police officers like some of my colleagues do, we have to really engage them in thinking about where the bounds of obedience are, and that they are not entitled to blind obedience. They are not entitled to uncritical obedience. They're not entitled to passive obedience. It does not come with the office that this is something that has to be earned and has to be constantly negotiated and maintained. And I think that the police officers and military people who do this well, and there are certainly examples of that. If you follow Patrick Skinner's Twitter feed, you see that there. It's a constant daily negotiation of making sure that respect, that justification for the obedience is there. And we see the same thing in warfare, because if people view the war or the action as unjustified, as the military is required to disobey unlawful orders, and there's a reason for that, right? You don't get to commit war crimes. There are certain things you simply do not get to do. And so I think it's worth having people think about the culture of their organizations and the narratives that they use to think about their power and their role in society. Because I think there are a lot of toxic narratives. I mean, we're finding out now that both the police force and the military have a white supremacist problem. I think that's indicative of certain kinds of toxic, elements or narratives within both of those communities, which is not to say all members of those communities are that way. But when you have narratives like that, it's worth thinking about what kind of obedience are you asking, and is that justified? And there's a long philosophical tradition of saying that blind and uncritical obedience is simply not morally justified. And in fact, so I was, watching a documentary on Charles I of England, who got his head lopped off because he asked for uncritical obedience from the parliament, and they said, no, you have to consult us. I mean, there's a historical example where literally command authority was renegotiated. And in one case, unconditional obedience was repudiated through regicide, through killing of a king. So these are issues that are sort of, and those issues are still with us because the issue between Charles and the parliament was the question of taxation, right? And who could raise money and who had to answer to whom? We're still, you know, the executive versus the legislative branch, and we're still wrestling with those issues today, right? Literally today.
I mean, speaking of those issues, I think the latest news is that the National Guard is being recalled, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the framing I have seen of this in the news is kind of played out. You know, there's so much that's been going on, sometimes it's hard to keep track. The way I saw this played out is that Trump blustered and deployed. And kind of before and during that, military brass wrote a bunch of letters and memos and talked to the press and said, this is bad, essentially, right?
Yeah.
And I was wondering what you – I wanted to kind of get your reaction from those official memos and letters. I think the one from General Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was probably the most interesting, probably the most kind of direct. what do you make of these? And do you think that these are – I mean, obviously, they must have done something, right? Because we have this idea that Trump is immovable and will just do whatever the hell he wants, right? But this seems to be an instance where he was – the generals actually made him back down, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was a case of, once again, that obedience is negotiated. Yeah, and this is an interesting case. I would, you know, I have many Civ Mill colleagues at the War College who have been writing the last week. I don't think they've slept at all about this issue because we have civilian control of the military, and the military is used in certain ways. And because of our history, it is used in the idea is that it is not to be used against our own populace. And of course, the reasons for that are rooted in the revolution. But they're also rooted in the English Revolution that I just alluded to. So the notion, so National Guard troops are often can be used in this capacity. But I think the real concern was when Trump announced that active duty, in other words, normal, not non-National Guard troops, were going to be deployed. And that is sort of, you know, crossing a Rubicon, literally, kind of situation that caused a lot of consternation because of the potential that you could have active duty, regular military troops potentially firing on or targeting their own civilian population. And it doesn't matter to me whether it's with rubber bullets or lethal force, you're still targeting people, you're still treating people as an adversary, as a combatant in a war. And of course, we had Tom Cotton's, you know, op-ed piece, which was essentially calling for that. And that's very troubling from the standpoint of the military profession, because members of the profession take an oath to uphold the Constitution. And so these, you know, a lot of these norms are seen as part of the military profession, also as constitutional norms. So I think this was sort of, I think for Trump, it was an attempt to sort of look tough. And if the governors can't handle this, then I'm going to call in the military and to perhaps answer some, you know, concerns about, you know, some of the looting and violence that had accompanied some of the protests, although that's largely, I think, almost exclusively disappeared by this point. But if we're looking at things last Monday, I think that that was a concern. But I think both from the military and also civilian people, you know, looked at that move and said, no, we're not. I mean, and it was pretty, even across partisan lines, which is unusual in this day and age, there wasn't sort of an immediate reaction. That's because of our history, I think, and because of how Americans look at obedience. No, you're not going to have, you know, it's bad enough having us have to watch police brutality. We're not going to watch our own military, especially not regular military, as opposed to National Guard, who have been called out during the Civil Rights Movement. The National Guard was called out in 1963. situations, similar situations. So that's not unprecedented. But the notion of having regular military in the streets, let's say, of Washington, there's just kind of this visceral reaction that showed, I think, where the lines of obedience were for people. And I heard from a lot of military people who were asking the question, what will I do if I'm asked to fire on my own co-citizens? Like, I don't think I can do that. I don't think I should do that. And if that were to happen, that would produce a major moral quandary, I think, for many people. So I think the former military coming out was important, but then you have someone like Milley writing this memo, just basically reminding everyone, okay, kids, here's the parameters of our profession. And I don't think that was a memo just for the audience of one. It was a memo for the forces as well, but it was also perhaps a reminder to the commander in chief, here are the limits of your authority. And we saw lots of military people, veterans, retired people, as well as other people coming out and making the same point. So it was a really, I tweeted last week that as a scholar, I was kind of thrilled that the core thesis of my book had not been disputed or had not been refuted at this point. But of course, feeling awful that this is, that this is even happening for that feeling. So, but it is really interesting to think about through the lens of obedience. And I think we have a few cases where Trump has floated something, and when he gets pushed back, especially if it's very strong pushback and if it's pushback from the right quarters, he does in fact back off. So you can see this negotiation happening, at least with certain kinds of issues, maybe not with all issues. But
what are those other places?
It tends to have to do with the military. So I referenced during the campaign when he said, people will commit war crimes for me, and the military establishment came out and said, and lots of other people came out and said no, and he backed off of that claim pretty quickly, right? So there's been they tend to be those kinds of they tend to be where he's pushing a norm that's widely held across partisan lines, and then get some pushback. But some of that is also, I think, the Trump administration tends to sort of float trial balloons. They through an anonymous source leaked that, oh, they're thinking about this, and then you start to get some pushback. I think some of the movement of, as we've watched through the administration work through COVID, initially it's, oh, this is no big deal, it's not a problem, we don't need testing, we don't need a lockdown. But then as things, in that case, as evidence emerges, as events on the ground overtake things, then there's a shift, right? They're not able to maintain certain kinds of positions. So I think it's it's something we can see, right? The negotiation of obedience and what those lines of authority are. Which is not to say, I don't want to come across as Pollyannish here, like. One would wish that the norms were not tested in such a way, but in certain cases, and I think this week was a pretty clear refutation of that. No, you're not to use military troops against your own populace. Like, people were just like, no, we're not doing that.
Yeah, I have to confess to my own kind of cynical reaction to these letters as they were initially rolling out. I saw them and I was like, okay, well, this is the CY, the cover your ass moment, right? They're getting these things in writing now so 6 years down the line when we're litigating all of this, they have something to point to. But then he pulled the National Guard out, which was a moment of small hope for me.
Perhaps your cynicism is not entirely unwarranted, but every once in a while, maybe there are norms that maybe out of altruism or maybe out of pure self-interest, one could argue there are certain norms that the military needs to function, right? So that this is both a moral commitment on their part. It's also a self-interest, right? They're a profession, and if they can't regulate themselves, if they can't maintain the standards of their profession, then they're going to be in trouble. I think you see that with the policing profession right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
The communities are saying, okay, guess what? We're going to, pick your favorite term, defund you or limit your authority, or we're going to potentially disband your unions. I mean, this is what happens when a profession does not sort of police its own boundaries and sort of allows itself to break norms and to break that trust. I mean, a definition of a profession is that it serves the common good, it serves the society. And when you fail to do that in certain important ways, then the society says, and part of profession is you're given special permission. The police and the military get to do things that the rest of us don't get to do.
They have a monopoly on legitimate violence, right?
They do. Right. But it's given with the idea that there's expertise there, that they will self-regulate and that they will serve the society. They act as agents of the society, not as their own, not in their own interest. And when that is breached, then you find the society saying, nope, guess what? We're taking back those permissions. And so I think we're seeing that pretty clearly with the if you think of policing as a profession, we could debate whether it is or not. But if you think of policing as a profession, I think you see that. That's what's going on right now, is people are like, nope, it's time to sort of renegotiate the terms of the contract.
What is it if it's not a profession?
So in the book, I talk about Alistair MacIntyre, who's a philosopher, who wrote a book called After Virtue. He talks about communities of practice. And so there could be a range of communities of practice. And a profession is on the sort of most restrictive end of a community of practice. But there might be other kinds of communities of practice that maybe don't rise to the level of a profession. A profession typically has to have special permissions, serve the common good, has to be self-regulating, has to demonstrate certain kinds of expertise. So historically, it's the military, the medical profession, the legal profession, clergy historically were considered a profession. I think generally policing is considered a profession, but certain other things like maybe education may not be considered a profession, but they're still a community of practice. So national security people, there might be a debate about whether they're a profession. I think most people would say they're not, but they're certainly a community of practice that has shared understandings and perhaps shared education and goals and identities and functions together in a certain way. So even if it's not a profession, we can still talk about the community of practice as a way of thinking about, you know, what they are as a collective.
When is disobedience a moral choice? Or I guess the correct moral choice, to be more specific.
I would say it's always a moral choice, yeah. But when is it? So maybe the question is, when is disobedience morally justified? Or
yes,
is it,
there, that's the better version of the question. Thank you. Thank you for workshopping this with me.
happy to, just like class, right? Disobedience tends to be morally justified, at least in my argument, when we meet some of the criteria, especially the just war criteria. So disobedience, especially civil disobedience, I mean, we have to look at what is the intention. Is the intention of me disobeying the law just to get out of paying taxes, which I don't like to do because I would rather spend that money in shoes? Or is the intention to refuse to pay my taxes to sort of make a larger point because I think the government is using my tax money for immoral ends? So is there a just cause? Am I protesting against the legitimate authority to make a point to my fellow citizens? Typically, disobedience is either to raise consciousness about a moral issue, or it's to actually change one's co-citizens' minds. So there might be different sort of stages of disobedience, especially civil disobedience. But I think disobedience is justified generally, and it has to be quite serious, right? So there's, you know, criteria in just war, like last resort, like have you tried other things before you engage in disobedience, right, to change what the system is. But this idea that it's something that's morally significant perhaps has not been amenable to change at this point. And usually for most people, it has to be some kind of serious moral or justice issue. So if we look at the civil rights movement, right, Blacks and other marginalized communities had failed to be able to exercise their political rights in other ways. And there was a long history of trying to renegotiate those boundaries and it being refused, often with violence in the Jim Crow South, for example, right? And so it gets to a point where the injustice is so egregious that one has to disobey the law in order to make the moral point or not be complicit in a moral system, in an immoral system, which in the military case, disobeying an unlawful order, say an order to commit a war crime, is to refuse to participate in an act of immorality or illegality. But generally, when it comes to disobedience, it needs to be over a fairly sort of significant issue. So I think I tell this story in the book. So my kids are home alone, and the rule is they are not to leave the house when they're home alone. My oldest falls down and hits his toe, and his toe starts bleeding pretty profusely. And my younger son, who has limited first aid skills, decides that he is going to leave the house and go to the neighbor's house to get help because there's no landline in the house. So he disobeyed our rule. Right. But he disobeyed it, I think we would all agree, for a good reason. Like the situation was serious enough. If my son just fell down, like bruised his toe, that would not justify the disobedience. But this was sort of a, you know, there's a large amount of blood. It was clear that it was a serious enough situation and he didn't have other resources to deal with the situation. Right. And so he disobeys so then he can go get help, not because he wants to leave the house to go play video games with his friends, but disobeys to achieve some end that we would agree is moral. So I think a lot of the discourse around things like civil disobedience and disobedience within the military are around those questions of justification and what is at stake. And that it's not just, I'm not going to pay my taxes because I want to buy more shoes. I think we would all look at that and say, yeah, that's not a good reason. Some of this is that these judgments are not individual judgments alone. They're also communal judgments. So I think that's part of it, we would say. Okay, yeah, Martin Luther King Jr., civil rights is a good reason to disobey, right?
How did you think we got to a place where the police are not considering these questions, where it is about deference? I know that's a big question, and it's kind of one of the ones that we've been asking. Everyone's asking themselves this week.
How long do we have? I think there's a lot of things going on, right? So some people have talked a lot about the militarization of the police, which I view more as an issue of what is the culture of policing become, particularly since 9/11. And some of that perhaps has to do with the global war on terror and the, you know, diminishing boundaries between the military and the police, where, when people get out of the military, they're being hired onto police forces. And so bringing perhaps a military sensibility to the police. But you also have, I think, a continued breakdown in social fabric, where if you talk to police officers, and I have former students who are police officers, they're asked to deal with all kinds of things that perhaps they aren't equipped to deal with. They're called to distress calls with where someone is mentally ill or where there's domestic violence or where there's a homeless person. In other words, they're dealing with all of these really social problems, but you're bringing a person with a gun and perhaps a militarized and threat mentality into a context where the use of force might be their first option because of how they're trained, but that is not necessarily the best first option in that context. And this is the same argument and discussion we have with using the military for military humanitarian interventions, right? You have people who are trained for combat having to go in and do something that isn't necessarily what we think of as conventional combat. And so I think this is something that both of those communities have struggled with. We also have, as we've talked about, you know, you have segments within both these communities where you have white supremacy, where you have what some people, I know people don't like the term toxic masculinity, but there is a certain culture of masculinity, which the research shows has toxic effects, that can be part of policing this, you know, I have a gun, so you will give me respect because I have a gun, as opposed to you giving me respect because I've earned your trust as a member of the community, those kinds of things. So I think there's a lot of things going on. And some of it is what police are asked to do and asked to sort of deal with. And I also think they're sort of, I mentioned this, my social media feed in regard to something else, but I think Americans like the easy button. So the Staples commercial, where it's the red button and you have a problem you can't solve it, you just hit the easy button. I think as an American society, we like the easy button. So when we don't know what to do, we call the police or we send in the military. And so I think that's also kind of a larger problem. The policing is designed for a very specific kind of thing. And they are good for that thing. You know, when I've been raped or when someone has broken into my house or someone is holding me at gunpoint, like that's who I should call because that is what they are for. You know, if my neighbor who is mentally ill or upset is shooting off fireworks in the street and not really endangering anyone, they may not be the best person to call. So some of it is also becoming more savvy about our social problems and stop trying to use the easy button for everything. We need to be, you know, properly funding education and all kinds of healthcare and all kinds of social services in all communities. And police need to, and the police who are doing things well are engaged in community policing. They get to know the members of their community. They're part of the community. They don't view them as adversaries. I mean, I think that just the fact that many police officers refer to people like me as civilians is problematic.
Right.
Because that's a language, that's a warfare language. Because we have civilians and we have, or non-combatants and we have combatants. And so for members of my community to refer to me in that way already sets up a relationship that is where there's separation between us, and a certain mentality, that I see, that I think we are seeing it, you know, play out in all of those horrible videos that are circulating on social media, police brutality, right? There's no, you know, there's no reason for those. So I think I think there's lots of complicated reasons, and my sociologist colleagues could probably help us with understanding those reasons. But I think a lot of it just has to do with how the culture of policing has developed and emerged, let's say, in the last 25, 30 years, which is a choice. We can undo that. We can change that.
No, I think you're right. I think Rosa Brooks wrote a really great book kind of about how, was it called, How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. Which has been, you know, that she kind of says that in the modern war zones, American soldiers are asked to be lawyers with guns. And that we've seen that trickle down into our communities. As these police officers, not only, you know, like there's ex-military in them, they get a lot of military surplus. They look to the military kind of for to set standards for them, yet they do not have near the amount of training or expertise that the American military does. And so, yeah, you end up coupled with that. I think I saw the chief of the Dallas PD, I believe that was him, saying that, kind of confirming that some of this is the problem, that, you know, they've been asked to do a bunch of things that would normally have been the purview of other parts of the community. Like now Dallas PD is being asked to, like, round up stray dogs. Why is that their job? Right?
Yeah.
It's going to lead to all kinds of problems. So I think that that kind of, I think you're right. Complicated issue of which these things are all parts, right?
Absolutely. And there's just a dynamic of when someone with a gun shows up in a situation, right? Even if that's not your intention, right? That you know, freaks people out. It produces certain reactions very quickly. Which then, if you are trained to respond to those kinds of reactions in a maximal kind of way, right? It's not, it doesn't take a genius to figure out how this is going to go south very quickly.
Right. Yeah, I think, and I'm sure not everyone will agree with me, but I think that there is an implicit threat of violence when there is a gun on someone's holster, whether that's, you know, and that also goes for all of the people marching around open carry in all parts of the country. People are afraid of you because there is an implicit threat of violence. You have a weapon that can take a life very easily, and that changes the dynamic of who you're interacting with.
Right.
It just does, whether you're a cop or a civilian. We are going to pause there for a break. We'll be right back after this.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to War College. We are on with Pauline Corin talking about her book on obedience. So at the beginning, we kind of talked about some pop culture examples, and I thought I would kind of interested to know, other than Antigone trying to bury her poor brother, what else do you look at to kind of help frame this for people in the book?
So I spend a fair amount of time looking at William Shakespeare's Henry V, because there's a famous dialogue in there where the night before the Battle of Agincourt, some of the soldiers are actually questioning whether or not Henry has a just cause. And unbeknownst to them, he's in disguise in the discussion. So there's this interesting kind of debate there.
Undercover boss moment of Shakespeare.
Yes, the undercover. And so that's sort of a classic scene, especially in terms of military obedience. But we also have things like, you know, the classic film, A Few Good Men, where you have, you know, Jack Nicholson's character who basically, you know, tries to make the claim that, you know, I'm doing the things you don't want to do, and so you need to sit down and be quiet, civilian, because you don't know what you're talking. He's sort of like the incarnation of Grossman's, like, that kind of sheepdog mentality, I think. So there's several movies that I talk about in the film or in the book that can be useful in sort of thinking through things. The Fifth is a big one, and Antigone is interesting, but also, you know, in the philosophical tradition, Socrates at one point is convicted and is sentenced to death and is given the chance to escape, and he refuses to do so. And he says to do so would be disobedient to Athens, to the state. So there's lots of, you know, different kinds of examples that, that you could look at.
I think you lighted on one that I think is very interesting that I want to talk about a little bit more. And maybe you and I have already talked about this, or Kevin and I have, which is possible. The Jack Nicholson, A Few Good Men speech. Yeah. Because I've never seen that file. Like, that clip is taken out of context and reshared on Facebook walls across the damn country. And no one ever follows it up with, the immediate thing that happens afterward where he gets arrested. Right.
Yeah.
They're completely taking that speech out of context and not really understanding how he's the villain of that story, it seems.
Yeah. He's not and I do talk about that at the end of the movie, like the two of the Marines who were on trial, like the younger one is sort of confused because they're convicted, right? He's like, I don't understand what happened. And the older Marine says to him, we're Marines. It was our job to protect the innocent, to protect the weak. And we failed to do that, right? That's the closing moment of the film, right? That's the clincher of the film. And so then you read that back on Nicholson's character. Yeah, he's not the good guy, right? And his character is designed to demonstrate a certain kind of, arrogance and insularity, and the idea that because I am a member of the military, I can break rules, I can break laws, I can, I don't have to, because a trial is, he's being asked to answer to the civilian or military justice. He's being asked to answer for his actions. And he basically pulls a Charles the First and says, yeah, I don't have to defend anything to you. And the justice system embodied by Tom Cruise's character, one of the few Tom Cruise, characters I actually like, basically says, actually, you do have to answer to us. Right. You work for us. We are your boss. And then the end of the movie has the two Marines coming back and, re-articulating that what went wrong was that they failed to protect one of their own. But more importantly, they failed to protect someone who was weak and vulnerable. They failed in their moral obligation as Marines. So it's an interesting sort of juxtaposition. Right. But very often, as you said, that meme is shared to lift up of that sort of sheepdog, like, you civilians are not fit to judge me, which is, of course, ridiculous because they work for us. If Jack Nicholson were a real person, like, I pay his salary, he works for me. So he does, in fact, have to answer to me. So, yeah. So what you're saying is really interesting, the way in which that particular meme and other ones like it, get used. I think a better film and one I talk about a little bit in the book, but not as much as I would like to, is Bruce Willis's character in the film The Siege, which was made before 9/11, but it basically asked the question of what would happen if there was a terrorist attack in New York. And there's
so Denzel Washington, Stanley Tucci, maybe not Stanley Tucci.
I've forgotten Anne's last name.
Bancroft.
But
no, not Bancroft.
No,
I know who you're talking. I can see your face. Anyway, yeah. This is not interesting podcasting. Let's talk. But The Siege is.
But The Siege is interesting because there's this. There's an imposition of martial law, right? And there's this conflict between Denzel Washington's character and Bruce Willis's character. And Bruce Willis sort of is representing maybe a more nuanced view of the Jack Nicholson character, but a character who says to people, you don't want me to come in, and you don't want to declare martial law because this is a blunt instrument. And you don't know what you're asking for. So I think that's an interest. So I wish people would like watch less of that meme, or if they do, watch the whole A Few Good Men movie, but then also watch The Siege, which is another sort of, there are questions of obedience and there too, lots of questions of obedience there too, and some of the same Civ Mill questions, but I think in a little more interesting and nuanced kind of way.
Does this speak to, as kind of something to go out on, the military-citizen duality you talk about towards the end of the book?
Yeah, it definitely does, because, you know, part of what I talk about in the book is, military veteran exceptionalism, the idea that perhaps they look at themselves, some members of those communities look at themselves, and civilians might look at themselves as sort of super citizens, right? So, you know, the discourse around having vets run for Congress, which they're certainly allowed to, there's this idea of, well, you know, they are better suited to serve in Congress to make judgments about national security because they've served, right? Well, they may have a certain kind of expertise, but that's only one kind of expertise that a senator or a congressperson might need. So it's worth us thinking about, you know, what is the relationship between the military and the civilian communities, and what are the conceptions of citizenship going on there. I'm not less of a citizen because I haven't served in the military. And so I think that there is a kind of dangerous, and you see this on a lot of social media pages. And anytime I weigh in on anything military, I will get sort of trolls and troll adjacent people, usually male, in my feed saying, A, you're a woman, and B, you're a civilian. Sit down and be quiet. You don't know what you're talking about. You do not get to weigh in on whether we should invade Iran or whatever the issue of the day is. So I think there's a way that we need to start to reconceptualize the relationship between the military and the civilians, and also civilians have an important role. I think people have ceded a lot of power to the military. There's a lot of deference to the military. Well, we'll let them decide what to do. And it's like, well, no, we have civilian control of the military for a reason. So, I mean, those are some of those issues, and that comes up in the movie The Siege. There's a sort of a famous scene where Denzel Washington says, his character says to Bruce Willis, his character, you can't shred the Constitution to save it, right? And the point he's making there is we have to preserve these constitutional norms, even in this sort of moment of extremity. And I think that, you know, that certainly, although the film was made before 9/11, those of us who lived through 9/11 can see those themes there, but they're still, you know, even in what's going on right now, I think they're sort of, you know, there's echoes there. So it's a really great movie. I would, it's Annette Bening, I think.
Yes. It's Annette Bening and Tony Shalhoub.
Yes, absolutely. And so there's interesting themes around ethnicity too, because there's a question of, you know, Arab Americans being sort of rounded up, sort of.
Well, they give people kind of an idea, because nobody's seen this thing, unfortunately, because it was released in 1996 and it was, or 98, yeah, and it was a huge box office disaster. And the critics panned it. and it's, you go back and watch it now, and
it's creepy.
It's creepy.
You're like, dude.
Yeah.
Dude.
Tony Shalhoub, I believe, plays an Arab FBI agent who is one of the people that is rounded up and put in an internment camp after Islamic attack in New York City. Right. There's a lot of creepy parallels in that movie. Yeah. It just came out, you know, just a few years before.
Mm-hmm. So it's definitely worthwhile, and there are these questions of obedience and professionalism and, you know, all of those things. So as much as I love A Few Good Men, I think The Siege is a more perhaps nuanced treatment. And even Bruce Willis's character, who is sort of the bad guy, right, still has, I think, what is a more nuanced and complicated portrayal of that kind of character and that kind of perspective. So I definitely commend it to your viewers, or to your listeners. Sorry.
All right. I think that's a good place to end. Pauline Corin, thank you so much for coming onto the show and walking us through this complicated topic. The book is On Obedience, Contrasting Philosophies for the Military Citizenry and Community.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. That's it for this week, War College listeners. War College is me, Matthew Galt, and Kevin Nodell. is created by myself and Jason Fields. We will be back next week with more stories from behind the front lines. Stay safe until then.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.